From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, it's year two of signing up for health insurance under the ACA.
They really give you a lot of information, but you have to do something active. You have to go on the site. You have to make choices.
The state of special ed in Michigan.
We have a history in this country of wanting kids with special needs and who are in special education to be kind of outside of the mainstream.
Lessons to be learned from what happened to a gay teacher in West Michigan in 1995.
He had a commitment ceremony with his partner then in October of 1995, and that was on a Saturday. The next Monday he went to work and his whole world changed.
And the chestnut. Why is this fruit so misunderstood? Those stories and much more today on Stateside. The USDA has set new standards for food in school.
There's a tremendous opportunity for our students to have much better nutrition when they walk into school.
So why isn't that happening? Why don't more kids have access to healthy food in school? I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, what's keeping schools from adopting the standards and why it matters? And then, finding the perfect chestnut tree to grow right here in Michigan.
People are starting to think of this now as a true investment and a true commercial industry.
Chestnuts later this hour, but first, open enrollment for the Affordable Care Act is in year two, and many of the benchmark plans available for 2014 are changing for 2015. So we wondered, how is enrollment gone, and what do we need to know for the folks who are first-time new enrollees into the healthcare program? Marianne Udall-Phillips is here. Of course, she's the director of the Center for Healthcare Research and Transformation at the University of Michigan, kind of our go-to person to help us figure out the ACA. Good to have you with us, Marianne.
Great to be here, Cindy.
We know the marketplace opened on November 15th. Clearly, we haven't seen the kind of headlines and hand-wringing and all the problems we had a year ago. How have things been going?
Well, certainly on the enrollment side, things have been going so much better than last year. People are getting through on healthcare.gov. And as of today, we've had nationally about 2.5 million people have enrolled for health coverage. We think about half of those are people who enrolled last year, and about half of those are new enrollees in the country. So that's pretty exciting. Much smoother. People are getting through, and that's great.
Now, if you were in the plan last year, the door is now closed. Closed a couple days ago. Closed on the 15th.
Right. So if you were in a plan last year and you didn't pick a new plan by December 15th, you will be automatically enrolled in the plan that you had last year. And that could be kind of challenging for some people because there were so many new plans, particularly in Michigan, and the rates for the plans changed. And so if you got a tax credit last year, your tax credit gets calculated based upon the new plans that come in. And some of those plans that were in just last year weren't the benchmark plans in the new year. So
we should actually define when we say the benchmark plans, meaning?
So there are different plans that are offered based upon the amount of copay and deductibles, and they're called metal levels. They're bronze, which has the highest copays and deductibles, silver, gold, and platinum. And the benchmark plan is the plan that the tax credits are calculated based on. That's a silver level plan, and it's the second lowest cost silver plan.
Okay, just so we have all of our terminology.
Yes.
It sounds like it was not a smart thing to just automatically re-enroll without doing anything.
It would be much better for most consumers if they actually went in and had looked at the plans, because there were so many new entrants. Many of those new plans were at a lower premium even than last year, and some of them were at just a slightly higher premium than last year. And the tax credit will get calculated based on those new plans. So people who didn't make any changes could see some fairly significant rate increases next year.
So brace yourself. If you didn't do anything active and you've been automatically re-enrolled, don't be surprised if changes are on the way.
Yes, people are looking at the plans they enrolled in last year. Some of them, based on where they fit on the tax credit side of things, are seeing increases of 20%, 10%. Whereas if they had changed plans, they could actually even get a reduction in their premiums or see a rate increase of only a couple percent.
Marianne, why are you seeing up to 20% increases?
because it's really an interesting phenomenon of the market. You know, we had in Michigan something like 135 new plans that are being offered now in our state. And that's great because it means there's more competition.
So which I would think would make prices go down.
Well, it does make prices go down on average. So on average, premiums only went up. If you did a simple average of all the plans in Michigan, the premiums only went up about less than 2%. But some of the plans went up much more than that. And because there were plans, so no plans on the premium itself went up more than 10%. But because of the way the tax credit works, it's a really complicated law. Mm-hmm. And the tax credit, because it's based on those lower cost plans, if you saw a new plan came into the marketplace that really wanted market share and came in at a very low rate, tax credit gets figured on that low rate. And so if you were in a plan that relative to that new plan is higher cost, it doesn't have as good a tax credit. And so that's why for you, you could see a 20% increase when on average the rates only went up 2%.
This seems to really require consumers to know a lot more about how insurance numbers are crunched and how this is all put together than probably most of us really care to.
That is absolutely true. And it is why there was a big push by the Department of Health and Human Services, mm-hmm. and by navigators and hospitals and health plans and others to say, look at the plans. Don't just let it happen, because the healthcare.gov website does do this calculation for you. You can compare plans. They do it by county. They really give you a lot of information, but you have to do something active. You have to go on the site. You have to make choices. And that is complicated. They all have different providers included in them. It's the market, you know, and that's what the Affordable Care Act was designed to do, was designed to strengthen the market and competition. But that can be more complicated for people.
Now, for folks that are newcomers, so did not enroll last year, they've got some time to come into the fold.
Yes.
And it sounds like you're saying there are better choices and it's just a better picture than it was a year ago.
That's absolutely true. So for people who didn't enroll, who are not being this automatically re-enrolled, they have until February 15th. To choose plans, and they will have many, many more choices. So just to give you an example, mm-hmm. Delta County, Michigan, the Upper Peninsula, was the county in Michigan that had the fewest choices last year. They only had 5 plans.
We talked about them. I remember that. Yes.
We do. And this year, they have 23 plans offered. 23 plans. And last year, the rate for the lowest cost, for the benchmark plan, the second lowest cost silver plan in Delta County was $357.87 without a tax credit, without a subsidy. This year, the lowest cost plan is a different company. It's the co-op plan, Consumers Mutual. That plan is $350.19. So in Delta County, you could find a cheaper plan this year than last year. And
okay.
Many counties across the state are seeing changes like that with pretty low rate increases. Kent County, Michigan, you can get a plan there now for 10% less than last year. So lots of new entrants that are making it more competitive if you were not automatically re-enrolled in your old plan.
So let's talk bottom line about do's and don'ts and what you need to do to make the best choices. At first, for those who are brand new coming into the fold, what are the main do's and don'ts?
Well, the first do is to go on healthcare.gov and to put in your information and shop and really look at what the plan choices are. And make sure you understand not just what the premiums are, but also the different copays and deductibles and who the providers are in those networks. You can go to the health plan websites to get more information about that. There are still people who are helping you get enrolled at many hospitals, many federally qualified health centers. You can get help from other people. Those are all do's. The don'ts would be, don't just pick a plan based upon the name or something that you heard. Really think about what those plans are, because there are just so many more choices.
And do's and don'ts for those who joined up last year. We know that December 15th is when it ended for the folks. And if it automatically re-enrolled because you didn't do anything, tell us what to do going forward.
Well, next year, make sure you do that shopping and don't just automatically re-enroll. Really take a look at what the choices are. Make an informed choice. You may really love your health plan and you may be willing to pay more for that health plan, and that's great, but you should go into it knowing that you've made that choice and that's a conscious choice. And so you really got to as soon as the marketplace opens next year, and we assume it'll be around the same time, start going in, shopping, seeing what the plans are, and making an informed choice. The other thing you can do, actually, if you have already been auto-enrolled, you've lost that opportunity for this year, make sure to take a look at your tax credit. Because of the way the tax credits get calculated, unless you actually make a choice in terms of how much you are getting back from the federal government, you may find that at the end of the tax year, you owe money if you're getting too much from the federal government because the tax credits have changed. So have a navigator at least, or your health plan, mm-hmm. at least help you calculate, recalculate your tax credit. You can adjust that after December 15th, and that might save you from paying for something later in the year.
Growing pains are a part of any program. It's kind of that ramping up. Last year was a shaky start. This is kind of, it almost think of a baby learning to walk.
Yes.
So you go from tottering to being able to kind of walk along pretty well to running and going. Where do you see the next couple of years for the exchange and for the marketplace?
Well, certainly from a technological mm-hmm. standpoint and from an understanding standpoint, it will get much better. Those things will all be stabilized. You know, we do have a complication because we have a case going through the courts now that's in the Supreme Court that could throw this all into confusion again because it has to do with the eligibility for tax credits for states that use the federal exchange like Michigan.
Like Michigan.
And it depends. You know, that case will probably be decided in June, and it really depends what the Supreme Court decides on that case. Again, that could throw all of this into more chaos if they determine that those states can't have a tax credit or people who live in those states can't have a tax credit. 87% of those in Michigan who enrolled last year got a tax credit.
So a lot of folks could be affected.
So a lot of folks. So that's why it's a little hard to predict the future from a policy standpoint. But from a technical standpoint, it's certainly only going to get smoother and people will understand it better, I think.
Mary Ann Udo Phillips, Director of Center for Healthcare Research and Transformation at the University of Michigan. Thank you so much.
Great to be here, Cindy. Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Federal law guarantees kids with disabilities have equal access to education. But what that actually looks like for Michigan students very much depends upon where you live. An investigation by Michigan Radio's State of Opportunity Project and Bridge Magazine turned up disparities in the way schools choose which students should be in special education and the actual level of those special ed services. Sarah Alvarez with State of Opportunity is with us now, along with Bridge Magazine writer Ron French. Ron, how many Michigan kids are identified as needing special ed services?
Currently, about 1 in 8 Michigan students are identified under one of the categories as in need of special education.
And how does that compare to the national rate?
It's actually about the same as the national rate. So we're not out of the ordinary there. What was illuminating was, though, the differences between the districts. When you look that it's not 12% in every district, you have districts where more than 1 in 5 students are identified as special education. You have other districts where less than 1 in 25 are identified as special education.
Give us a clear idea why the percentage of kids in special ed matters.
It matters a lot because once you are identified as in need of special education, your education trajectory changes dramatically. Your chance of graduating drop a lot. Your chance of dropping out increase. Your chance of suspension goes up. And so once you are identified, your chances of having an economically successful life drop.
Sarah, you've been talking to parents and kids to get an idea what it looks like to these disparities from districts. What are you hearing?
Well, there are a lot of disparities. And I think the biggest indictment of the system is that truth that it hurts your chances to be economically successful in the future if you're identified as special education. That's not the way special education is supposed to work. And I think it is different in every district. And it's not that teachers aren't working hard. It's not that people, are intentionally punishing these kids. But we have a history in this country of wanting kids with special needs and who are in special education to be kind of outside of the mainstream. And so I think there still is some fighting against that. And some of these kids are difficult to manage. one of the people that I interviewed, who's a special education director in Livingston County, said she often thinks it's an issue of skill rather than will. The people want to do right by these children, but they don't necessarily have the skills to make an impact with them, and that can be very frustrating. It's also that a lot of parents don't know their rights when it comes to special education and don't really know how to navigate the systems.
And you actually talked to one mother whose little guy was suspended 19 times in kindergarten?
Right. Now, the school can't confirm that because of federal privacy laws, but he was a kindergartner. He had an IEP, which is an individualized education plan. That's what kids in special education have. So we know that that plan wasn't working if he was suspended 19 times. She does think that things are getting better, but she's had to really learn how to be an advocate for her son, and it's something she's kind of had to learn from scratch.
Ron, what's out there to help a struggling student before somebody decides you're going to special education services?
Well, that's the key, and that is something that the state is trying to address now. They're trying to get some programs going, and a few school districts are doing it on their own. Some of the problem there is there's not a consistency. You have some districts that do a better job than others. But what you're finding is that, as you said, Cynthia, a lot of the efforts need to be made before they are identified as special needs. This was something I was shocked by. 80% of the students who are in special education have no cognitive disabilities. They ought to be able to learn. Experts seem to think that the state ought to be able to cut its special education figures by about half if younger students in the early grades were getting additional support before they are in special ed. And that's that we're talking about kids who are struggling to read, struggling with their math. When they struggle, they tend to act out sometimes. And so there were a lot of reasons why it's been traditional for schools to then place them in special education. But if you look at the rates, you see that schools that have decided to make a concerted effort at extra support for kids who are struggling in pre-K, kindergarten, first grade, second grade, their special education numbers go down.
Sarah, did anyone you talked to hold out distinct hope that these disparities might be evened out and things might become more consistent throughout the state?
They did. There are advocates, a lot of them, and special education teachers and directors who do believe that this move towards focusing on outcomes for kids with disabilities is very hopeful if we stick to it. And I have a lot of advice from parents to other parents on the State of Opportunity website and from some advocates as well. Everybody who I talk to is really hopeful about their own child's abilities and likelihood to be successful and the system overall. But it is not easy, and if it doesn't get more attention, it's unlikely to happen.
And the state recognizes the disparities exist, and that's the first step. I think that you're going to see a lot of efforts in the next 5 years or so to try to address these issues.
Ron French's story on special education for Bridge Magazine can be found at bridgemi.com, and you can hear Sarah's reports. Just go to michiganradio.org and click on the link for State of Opportunity. Sarah and Ron, thank you so much for talking with us.
Sure.
Thank you.
In Michigan, you can be fired or you can be denied housing for being gay. That's because there are no LGBT protections in the state's Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act. The story of teacher Jerry Crane from West Michigan illustrates that. Crane was a gay high school music teacher who was outed by his student, fired, and then several months later died of a stress-related heart attack. My next guest is writing a book about Jerry Crane's life. The book will be called Gay Teacher, a story about love, hate, and lessons yet to be learned. Christine Yarrett is an attorney from Grand Rapids. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you very much.
Tell us more about Jerry Crane.
Well, Jerry was a high school music teacher in Byron Center. He was a well-loved teacher. His evaluations described him as the teacher who built their music program. He was also a gay man, and while he was not out in any way at his school, he had a commitment ceremony with his partner then in October of 1995. And that was on a Saturday. The next Monday he went to work and his whole world changed.
What happened?
Well, the school, that Monday, they called him into the office. They questioned him. The rest of the school year, he was ostracized. He was harassed. The school board issued a resolution that gay men or gay people are not a proper role model as teachers. And he had a horrible rest of that school year, at which time he was forced to resign. And then 6 months later, he collapsed. And a week later, at age 32, he died. There was an autopsy, and the coroner did conclude that the premature death was in part because of the stress of the way he was treated by his employer.
What do we know, Christine, about how he was outed?
What happened was that someone found out when they were searching for musicians to play at their commitment ceremony. They had called different people, and through the process of who they called, someone found out the reason for it. They told school officials, and there was a student who showed up at the commitment ceremony and went in the back and took a program and left with it, and then that program was turned into the school.
So he was not trying to make a public statement at all. He was trying to just have a private ceremony with his partner and make a commitment. He wasn't making any political statements.
He was not. And when this issue came out also, he was not interested, in making it public. It became public and he couldn't stop that. But even when it was public, he was a quiet man in terms of public issues like this. He loved being a teacher. He loved music and he was a wonderful teacher. And that's what he wanted to do. And even after this received attention, he still did not want to be the person that he was forced to be, which was the public name for being a gay teacher.
I'm wondering, was there support in the community for this man amidst the hounding and the harassment and the silent treatment from his colleagues?
There was. It was quiet and it was in limited pockets. Certainly the local LGBT community supported him significantly. In fact, some people in the community wanted to do more in a more vocal way, and he didn't want that. There were people who wanted to protest at the school, and he didn't want that. So that didn't happen. Eventually, another important part of the story is a small group of ministers and one rabbi in West Michigan got together, and they formed a group called Concerned Clergy. And they were upset by the way others in both other ministers, rabbis, I shouldn't say rabbis, it was really ministers at that time, were condemning him, and the way those they were using the Bible to condemn him. And so this group got together. They formed a group called Concerned Clergy. They placed a full-page ad in the Grand Rapids Press supporting him, and they started a process of educating people and pursuing their view, which was that there was nothing inconsistent with being gay or lesbian and being Christian.
What happened after his death? Was there any shift in position from those who had been hounding him?
No, and that's a very sad part of the story. When he died, his partner received a telephone call either the day or right after the day he died, telling his partner that we sent the next check. His next paycheck has already gone in the mail, and telling him to return it when he received it. And then they fought his partner. There was a one-year severance agreement when he resigned at the end of that school year, and they stopped those payments, and they had to go to court. His former partner had to go to court and then had to go to the appellate court to be able to receive that money that he was owed. So that was a horribly brutal part of it, was that even after he died, the school district did not show compassion, did not show anything that you would expect in terms of recognizing his humanity and certainly no apologies of any kind.
I'm talking with Christine Yared. She's an attorney from Grand Rapids who's in the middle of writing a book about high school teacher Jerry Crane from West Michigan.
a gay man who had a commitment ceremony with his partner on Saturday, was outed at school the following Monday, and spent months being harassed and ostracized by fellow staff, administrators, and the parents. And he eventually died from a stress-related heart attack. He was only 32. How does this story about a gay teacher in the mid-1990s relate to life in 2014? Why do you need to write this book?
It is so relevant today, and it's very sad that it's relevant today. If Jerry were to return, I think it would be hard for many people to look at him and say, you know, we recognize you died because of the discrimination that you had to experience, and here we are almost two decades later, and teachers are still losing their jobs just for being gay or lesbian or transgender. So you mentioned the Elliot Larson law. That's the Michigan civil rights law. In Michigan, it is still legal to fire somebody to discriminate employment based on their sexual orientation or their gender identity. Most states in our country do not have protections, employment protections for gay people, and our federal government hasn't passed an employment discrimination law in this regard.
And when something like this happens, you have to just wonder, can you even begin to get your mind around the impact that firing someone like a Jerry Crane or other teachers who've lost their jobs because of being LGBT, what that does to LGBT students who are still trying to figure out who they are and they watch this happen?
Absolutely. That's an excellent point. We say that we care about children as a society. I think there is more awareness about this issue and about what children go through in their adolescence with bullying and coming to terms with this issue. But the idea that an adolescent looks to their teacher and sees that their adult teacher is not safe in their job, that adult teacher cannot stand up for them, or that adult teacher who's found out to be gay or lesbian or transgender loses their job. Certainly we can't expect our children to be safe if their adult teachers aren't safe for who they are.
Christine, you're raising money for this book through Kickstarter. How much are you trying to raise, and what do you want to use this money for?
Yes, I've started a Kickstarter project to raise $23,000 to self-publish the book. I first tried through traditional publishers. I'll be using this book to self-publish it and to promote it. I want to be able to tell this story. I want to be able to go to groups that care about teachers, that care about children, and tell this story so we can have change, legal and cultural change in our community on these issues.
Am I gathering that you didn't get any response or enough interest from regular publishers?
Correct. And you know, and I think one thing is, it's kind of interesting where we are in society, is that we have, in one way, our country's made progress, and in one way, we're seeing a lot of progress with gay marriage, not in Michigan, but in other states. And I think that, in my experience from talking to people, is that many people hear this story, and they just think it's a thing from the past, and they see it as, yeah, that was horrible, but certainly that couldn't happen now. And there certainly are schools now who wouldn't treat a gay teacher that way, but that, as we know in Michigan, that's still happening today. It happened for a teacher in the Detroit area this past fall, who lost her job for merely being pregnant, choosing to have a child with her partner.
In fact, we spoke with Barb Webb on this program when all of that was going on. Although that was a private school, and it should be pointed out, Jerry was working in a public school.
He was.
Yeah, yeah. And along with raising money through the Kickstarter campaign, you also are reaching out and asking to talk to people who were part of Jerry's story, who saw that happen, or other LGBT discrimination stories?
Correct. And if I'm interested in talking to anybody, whether they're a former student, a teacher, a parent, and I'm interested in talking to people that have had more recent stories. So in addition to chronicling Jerry's story, I'm telling the story of what is the current climate, and I'm interested in hearing from teachers from any state about what their experiences have been as a gay or lesbian or transgender teacher, and or from parents or students who have had experiences like that and how it's impacted their lives.
This forthcoming book will be called Gay Teacher, A Story About Love, Hate, and lessons yet to be learned. My guest has been Grand Rapids attorney Christine Yared. Christine, it's been great talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The USDA has laid down new standards of nutrition for school meals, school vending machines, and snack bars. The USDA wants to limit fat, sugar, sodium, and calories. A study by a team at the University of Michigan's Institute for Social Research finds how badly school menus and food offerings needed to be overhauled. Yvonne Terry McElrath is an author of the study. Yvonne, what are the five school nutrition components called for by these USDA standards?
They actually call for a lot of different areas. And our study only looked at a few very specific ones that would be easy to confirm. We didn't look at specific nutrient, caloric, sodium content levels that would require some pretty serious analysis. So we looked at things that you could easily determine, are they there, are they not there? So for example, we looked at, are there fruits or vegetables available wherever foods are served? Are there any sugar-sweetened beverages available? And so for middle schools, that includes regular sodas, high-calorie fruit drinks, and sports drinks. For high schools, it doesn't include sports drinks just because there's a few specific calorie differences at the high school level. We also looked at whether or not they had French fries, deep fat fried fries. There are ways of making fries that are baked, but we were looking only at the deep fried. We also looked at, are there candy regular fat snacks available? So that would include candy, of course, and then high-fat baked goods, you know, chips, that kind of thing.
The stuff that we see in, like, for example, highway rest stop vending machines.
Yes.
Like, we're nothing good.
Exactly.
I mean, it's all good, but it's not good, if you know
exactly
what I mean.
Yes.
Sure. So you were trying to determine if schools at the middle school and the high school level were conforming with what the USDA recommended.
At the time we were in the schools. Now, at the time we were in the schools, it was 5 years. We went from 2007 and 8, school year 07 to 08, up to school year 11-12. And it's important for people to understand the new USDA requirements that were put in place as a result of the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act of 2010. They didn't start implementation until the 12-13 school year. So we're looking at what it looked like before.
Okay.
And then gradually the new standards were put into place. They started that first year for a lot of this. Most of the school meal requirements were put into place then. And then they're slowly being rolled out. This current year is the first year for what we call competitive venue standards. Those mean standards for anything that competes with the school lunch meal. So vending machines, stores, snacks, a la carte sales, all that kind of stuff. We were looking at what did things look like before the new standards went into effect, so we could get an idea of how much of an impact are we likely to see from these new standards.
So these new standards, again, as we were saying, want to limit fat and sodium and calories and sugar. So they're all good things. So leading up to that, give us an idea how many middle school kids were at schools where those standards had been in place.
Very, very few. If you're looking at all the five that we looked at, and there's one thing I should probably add to this as well, the requirement that fruit and vegetables be available wherever foods are sold is sort of it's a requirement for school meals. It's a suggestion for competitive venues. So there is a slight adjustment for that. The healthy people recommendations say that should be in there. It's not part of the competitive snack guidelines. But what we found is that almost no one was in a school that had all five of these. Less than 2% of all middle school students attending public schools in the United States, and less than 1% of high schools. Virtually no one was in a school where the whole nutrition environment, again, this is meals and stuff you can buy outside of meals, where it was a solid, healthy, nutritional surrounding.
And of course, some of that is, shall we say, market driven, because what are they going to buy? What are the kids going to want to eat? It is going to be the French fries, or it's going to be the candy bar. In fact, I remember serving as lunchroom mom at my children's grade school, my child's grade school. And when the bell rang and they had to go out to the playground, when I saw the things that were getting pitched away and mom had carefully packed the apples and the fruit, either they were being traded for cookies or they were just being tossed.
That is one of the concerns that has been raised about the new standards. There are organizations that are very concerned that these standards are too difficult to implement. in U.S. schools. And they cite concerns such as increased waste, the cost that's associated with having to provide healthy fruits and vegetables, trying to make the switches to whole grain, whether it's crackers or breads
buns.
Or buns. Mm-hmm. Yeah. A pasta is a big one, trying to find whole grains that the kids will eat and enjoy. And so there have been different organizations that have said, no, we need to roll these things back. They're too problematic. And then we have other organizations that say, it's a hard thing to make a big change like this. If you think about deciding to make your home kitchen healthy, it requires some hard work, trying new things. You try some things, they don't work. You try other things, they do work. It's a period of transition. And so there have been difficulties, but there are also really good success stories that are coming out as well.
And the hope is that the long-range data will support that kids are going to be healthier, because what are we seeing with these schools? You're telling us that fewer than 2% of middle school kids have been at schools where all of these components are in place, and less than 1%. And what are we seeing of high school students? And then what are we seeing in terms of obesity in these groups?
There are a lot of different studies that have looked at this. For ours, and again, we're just taking a very tiny slice of the different new standards that are going to be involved. For the ones that we looked at, we found that for high school students, if you have three or more of the five standards that we looked at, you're much less likely to have overweight and obesity among your students. The predicted probabilities were about 2.3 percentage points lower. And you might think, what's 2.3 percentage points? That ends up to be roughly 200,000 kids. And so while it's a small percentage point difference, it can be very meaningful in terms of some individual's life. And you put a lot of those individuals together, and it can make a big impact from a public health perspective in terms of dealing with the health consequences of overweight and obesity.
So what should we take away from your research?
I think there's a tremendous opportunity for our students, for our middle school students, our high school students, and of course our elementary students, to have much better nutrition when they walk in a school. And that improved nutrition has been shown to translate into better outcomes. In studies other than ours, and in ours we found at both the middle school and the high school level, if you look at some different components, for example, sugar-sweetened beverages, if you didn't have sugar-sweetened beverages anywhere in your school, minority students were much less likely to be overweight, obese at both the middle school and high school levels. And so you can have a big impact for a subpopulation of your overall students, as well as an impact on your students overall. Different studies have shown in the past that when states have made strong policy gains, they've seen improvements in student nutrient intake, decreases in student fat intake, improvements in overweight obesity. And so if we have this kind of national ability to improve state nutrition environments, that can mean all of our kids have the opportunity for better outcomes, as opposed to just being in a state where that particular state has made an improvement in their policies.
So we hang in there and watch these get implemented and phased in, and it'll be interesting to see if we were having this conversation, let's say, in 10 years, what kind of impact it could have.
And I think the important thing for that is to make sure we do hang in, because there are efforts to try and either turn down the level of strength of some of the policies or to provide waivers for schools to get out of them altogether. And if we stop now, we're going to be still at the point where we were, where almost no one had these good nutrition environments. Change is hard. Schools definitely need support to make the changes. USDA is trying to provide grants for kitchen equipment, the ability for training, education. We just need to keep moving forward and continue to improve what we can offer our students.
Yvonne, thanks so much for talking with us today.
It was my pleasure.
Yvonne Terriot McElrath is with the University of Michigan Institute for Social Research. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire.
Did you know Michigan leads the nation in chestnut production? Yet most of us probably have never even eaten a chestnut. And that is something my next guest wishes to change. Dennis Fulbright is here. He's a plant pathologist and professor with Michigan State University. And tell us, Dennis, about this fruit that we call chestnut.
Well, you're right. It is a fruit. It's not so much a nut. It belongs in the acorn family, with the oaks and the beech nuts. We call it a nut because it comes off the tree kind of looking like a nut, but it's really a fruit and it's respiring very fast like a fruit, like a strawberry.
Meaning what?
Meaning it has a shelf life that is rather short. I mean, most nuts like a walnut or an almond you can keep around for maybe, who knows, a year or two. But a chestnut should be eaten by, well, it falls in October and it should probably be eaten by January.
Thus, we have that association with Christmas. You have spent the past 20 years working with Michigan's chestnut growers in search of the perfect chestnut tree to grow in our state.
Right. It wasn't easy. People started with what was available, which isn't always the best material, the best what we would call germplasm, the best tree. So we had to hunt around, and it became obvious very quickly that there was a cultivar that was from the Japanese and the European combination, or a hybrid. We call it a Japanese-European hybrid. And it's what's frequently grown in Spain or Portugal or even some places in France. But it grew very well in Michigan.
It was happy in Michigan.
It was extremely happy. I think it maybe is a little stressed from our cold winters, but it's vigorous and it comes back and it produces a lot of chestnuts.
How many growers do we have in Michigan?
We have over 100 growers, and the average size farm is about 4 to 5 acres. But now we are getting to 20 to 100 acre farms. People are starting to think of this now as a true investment and a true commercial industry.
And I saw that members of the CGI, the Chestnut Growers Incorporated in Michigan, harvested 80,000 pounds of chestnuts last year, and they're predicting they're on their way to 100,000 pounds. And I'm wondering how come you think most of us have not even seen, yet alone eaten, a chestnut?
I'm a plant pathologist, so the marketing aspects of all of this has been just amazing. 100,000 pounds disappears into the fabric of our supply chain very quickly. A lot of I like to tease my molecular biology friends. They think they're working in the black box inside the cell. But I tell you, the real black box is the handshake on a loading dock at 3 a.m. in the morning at a produce terminal. It's really amazing how much business is still done that way.
Interesting. I think anyone listening to me talking who went to downtown Detroit, especially in the 50s and 60s at the holidays, you remember going to downtown Hudson's right there on Woodward where the big Christmas windows were. And there would always be, by the Christmas window display, the guy with the cart, the steamy cart, selling the bags of the hot roasted chestnuts. I remember eating them, and I love them. But I'm wondering, how would you describe their taste?
It's pretty indescribable. I mean, it's just a sweet, nutty flavor. Maybe vanilla-like. Perhaps it's I mean, we'll all agree it's like a potato, but it's not a sweet potato. But it's a potato that is sweet.
Yeah.
And the better you get at roasting them or cooking them, the better they taste. But you can put them into the turkey stuffing, and they'll sweeten up the bread. Anything that they are near, they sweeten. So you could put them with the Brussels sprouts in vegetables, or with the squash, and they'll sweeten it up. And this is always the biggest surprise. I had one young man come up to me and say, "I really like your chestnut soup, but it's just too sweet. Could you use less sugar?" And I said, "No, that's nature's sugar. I added no sugar to the soup."
Well, tell us about preparing and what you do if you find chestnuts at the market. What do you do with them?
Well, you have to get the shell off. So there's two things to think about. One, if you're just going to roast it over a grill or in your oven, you just want to make one cut. I know there's a lot of recipe books that say two, but why double your trouble? Just make one cut sort of across the equator. So think of it as a little globe with a north pole and a south pole, the point at the top and the colored spot down in the bottom, and cut half the equator. And then you put it into the oven, and they'll start to smile. Don't get faked out yet because they're not done. It really does take 15 to 20 minutes at 350 or so to get them done. So they go from a carrot-like or fresh carrot, fresh potato-like hardness to a soft carrot or soft potato-like hardness in that 15 to 20 minutes. We suggest that people add a little water to the cookie sheet if it's in an oven, or you can even microwave them. Same way, one cut across the equator. They'll open like a clamshell, but wrap them in a paper towel that's been dampened, and that keeps their moisture up in a microwave.
As I'm microwaving,
yeah,
okay.
As you microwave. Don't go much more than a minute or so. But, of course, it depends on how many chestnuts you put in there and what their size is.
And then how do you use them in recipes? Obviously, you can throw them, dice them and throw them in stuffing, but what else?
Right. So the next part is to take the shell off. And our chestnut growers take the shell off. We have the only commercial Italian chestnut peeling machine in the Western Hemisphere, as far as we can tell. And we take the shell off down in Jackson, Michigan, and we sell that online. So, you know, they can go to the chestnutgrowersinc.com and buy. You know, all of us in the business say, I love peeling the chestnut once.
And then I'm very happy to let something else take over. Right?
Right. And then I'm willing to pay for the package of peeled chestnuts. But you have to get the shell off and the paper that's underneath it. Okay. You can do that by cutting them in half. That's the best way. Just cut them in half and drop them in the boiling water for about 20 minutes. And a lot of them just come out of the shell on their own. And the ones that don't, it's not so hard, except for you're burning your fingers a little bit.
Now, are there recipes available on the website?
There are recipes available. And most of them were made by Michigan chefs. And we had a little program with them, and they served these up at their restaurants. And then we had to go test them.
Of course.
And then,
tough job, but somebody's got to do it.
Right. And, you know, you can find on that website chestnut pate. It's just an amazingly sweet vegetable pate. You know, you can find how to roast them. You can find chestnut cranberry pesto, a lot of things on there. Just your typical chestnut stuffing that you might want to use. My favorite is chestnut hummus.
Oh,
take out the chickpeas and put in the sweet chestnuts.
And you know, when you realize we lead the nation in chestnut production, it sounds like as more people get the sense of what can be done with this chestnut and how to work with it, it really does have the potential to be a very important crop in our state.
It does. I mean, it's a tree that drops a I keep trying to search for the right word, and after 20 years, I still haven't. But it's a food stuff. It's like it's the material you build foods from. It can grind it into a flour. You can use it as a puree. You could put it in as chunks. It's gluten-free flour. So if you're a celiac and you're tired of the tasteless rice flour, you can add some chestnut flour to it and get some very nice sweet flavors and sweeten that up without adding any gluten. And we even are involved in beer making.
Well, you can learn more about the Michigan chestnut. Just go to Chestnut Growers, Inc. That's INC.com. ChestnutGrowersInc.com. You'll find recipes. You'll find cooking instructions. Dennis Fulbright is a plant pathologist with Michigan State University and clearly a champion of the Michigan chestnut. Dennis, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer was Peg Watson. Contributors are Mike Blank, Zach Dieterman, Emily Fox, Haley Hirschman, Mercedes Mejia, and Annie Norris. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.